Welcome back, Ruby Tuesday. I'm Patrick Ruby of Sports on Earth, and today's guest is coming to us from across the globe, all the way from the Sochi Olympics. It's my Sports on Earth colleague, all-around great guy, and world-spanning reporter, Chuck Culpepper. Chuck, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much, Patrick. Thank you.
Very honored to have you, especially given that when we were taping here, I believe it is about 4 to 5 a.m. your time, and I believe you're going on very little sleep right now. So very grateful that you are, you know, you're pushing through for the good.
I've gotten used to the schedule now a bit, you know, a vampire schedule here. So
the Olympics are always like that. I remember being in Athens, that being the same way. Like it was like being in Las Vegas. Like I never really knew what time it was. You know, you go inside, you go outside, days become night. You don't really know what happened. You're in and out of arenas. You're in and out of the big media center. It's an interesting experience for those who haven't done it.
That's right. There are always those times where you've been inside for a while and you walk out and you're surprised either that it has become dark or that it has become light again. So there's always two or three of those days where you kind of don't know what it is outside. So
let me start with two really basic questions about being over there, which is one, do you have a shower curtain in your hotel room? And two, have you considered adopting a stray dog?
I do not have a shower curtain that is hanging on a rod with rings like we do normally. I have one that's in its original bag, like you buy it in the store, you know, when it's flat. And mm-hmm. It's hanging from the little hook that you buy it with on a rail. So obviously they put one in there with the thought apparently of installing it, but there is no railing on the top of the shower, there's no rings, so it just sits over there.
So you have a curtain but no way to use it.
Right, exactly. So I mean I would have to hold it up, I guess, if I wanted to use it.
Which
so.
Would really defeat the purpose of showering. I guess if you were creative, you could kind of go like one arm holding it up. But again, I feel like you would probably get the room even wetter that way.
Right, right. It's you know, you were talking about Athens. The odd thing is, I remember there. I was in a pretty nice hotel there, and that also didn't have a shower curtain, and the water just flew all over the room. And you know, you do run across that every so often in, I guess, Europe or. One time I was in India and I didn't have a shower curtain. So I do have practice at this. So
yeah, when I was in Athens, I was not in a nice hotel. It was a fairly basic dormitory type setting. I think it was one of those temporary things built for the games, for the media. But yeah, it was this thing where it was basically the whole bathroom was essentially the shower curtain where there was like a drain in
right.
the middle of the floor. And just like everything gets wet.
Yeah, that's what I had.
Oh,
that's
but part,
what I had.
Part of me was like, this is great because in some weird way, everything stays cleaner.
Yeah, it is. It is. And, you know, the odd thing with me is I have a tub. So, you know, there's a tub there. So sometimes I just use it as a, you know, as a bath rather than a shower because the water does fly everywhere when it's, and you kind of worry about it here, you know, because these buildings we're kind of slapped together, right. You know, and you wonder,
if you get too much water on the floor, is the floor going to give way?
Yes. And is the person below me going to suffer in some way?
Well, see, that's what separates you from me is you're actually worrying about the person below you and I just don't want to die. But I did ask though, the whole dog thing. I mean, it did seem like there were a lot of stray dogs. There's a lot of talk here about dogs being carted off to die. Dogs being saved in the little makeshift rescue. I'm a dog person, so just every single photo of the stray dog like broke my heart. Is that a real thing? Like, are there a lot of stray dogs around there? Have you adopted one? Have other journalists adopted them?
It is a real thing. It is quite something to see. It's there are a few cats too as well, but mostly you see dogs. Mostly mm-hmm. That's what I've noticed. I was just walking back from toward the media center at about 2 a.m. and, you know, walked through this neighborhood with two-story houses, pretty nice neighborhood, mm-hmm. two-story houses and dogs milling about there. Probably saw 5 on that walk.
Jeez.
And then, you know, you'll be at a, you know, I was walking in front of this speed skating venue the other day and there went one there. I've gotten to where I take photos of them. Mm-hmm. sometimes there'll be, say there'll be a checkpoint for a shuttle bus or something, or a shuttle van, and the people waiting at the checkpoint will have a dog just lying there with them. And sometimes you'll see, one day I saw three soldiers and a dog, so they are, it is a regular fixture here. And I'm told, it's hard because of the language barrier, I can't really figure it out, but I'm told that the people who live here actually quite like them, that they're sad that they've been thinned out somewhat. Some of them are sad that they've been thinned out somewhat for the Olympics, and that they kind of like having them around, even though they don't own them. It's kind of an odd thing. It's for us. It's unusual, because one thing you wonder when with so many running around is, is the species, the dog, simply valued less in this culture than it is in ours? And that could be, if you were raised to think this is kind of just another animal, then you would think this was just probably think this was just another animal. I don't know if that's true here. I haven't been able to talk to enough people to figure out that, but there's definitely some kind of relationship between canine and human that is unprecedented in my experience, because they're not ubiquitous. It's not crowds of them, but it's a regular sight here and there, and then here and there during a given day.
Have you gotten a chance to sort of get out of the Olympic loop of the media center, the event venues, the hotels, and sort of get out into the town and talk to people at all, even with the language barriers? Or have you mostly been on sort of that normal reporting kind of loop? No, go ahead.
I've been on the normal reporting loop every day but one, probably. Every day but one. And I did make it just tonight into the city of Sochi, and it's a 45-minute train ride on a beautiful new looking train. And it's I have to say that, because of the discussion of terrorism and the threats here, and because we are almost like teenagers, and I'll say that, I mean that in a good way, in that we check in with our editors constantly to let them know that we're all right. And because that has been such an issue preceding these games, I had a picture of Sochi, the city, that maybe it was a bit more barren or a bit more threatening looking than I thought. Instead, it is absolutely beautiful. Flowers and this gorgeous art museum, this in this stately building, and great architecture in the train station, and it is really, really beautiful. And of course, it's on the sea. Palm trees. Palm
Right,
trees at
it's a
the
resort
Winter
town,
Games.
basically,
Yes, it
right?
is. You know what it's like? It's one of those classic resort towns from It reminds me, in the UK, for example, back in the middle of last century, people would go to resorts there on their coast. And then here came the easy flying, so people started going to Spain and France and Italy. And so a lot of those towns, they didn't die along the UK coast, but they lost a lot of their, business, and they did sort of lose a lot of their energy. I'm told that that was one of the things that happened with Sochi as well. For example, you see a lot of Russian tourists in Dubai. It's pretty easy to get to from here, and they go down. And so I'm told that the Olympics, one of the bits of thinking in having the Olympics here was that it would help,
Revive.
revive, yes. But this town is just a pleasure to walk through. It's really beautiful parks, and then every once in a while, you look out in the Black Sea is out there, and when you're walking along, and I was just really, really impressed with it. It wasn't how we view Russia from afar. I'd never thought of a place like this being in Russia when I, grew up thinking about Russia or whatever, and it also wasn't what I pictured relative to the fact that it was, that it's said to be possibly under threat, and that there's very heavy security in the train station.
Well, I'm glad that you are enjoying subtropical Russia in February
Yeah.
at the Winter Olympics. While I'm here in DC and it's freezing cold, and we're getting
Six,
more snow again.
six, 61 degrees today, it was.
While we have the Winter Olympics in LA next time, that's what I think.
Yeah, you know, I have these thermal underwear, and I keep putting them on every day just for, you know, just out of ritual. I think, well, I went to the trouble to go buy them. You know, I went to that store on Fifth Avenue. I forget the name of it, but they're supposed to have these great. Somebody recommended it to me, and now there's really no reason to be wearing them. So,
Just tell me you're not in shorts and I'll feel okay.
I'm not in shorts.
So when we set up this podcast, we were going to just talk about the Olympics, but we're taping on a Monday night in America, which is Tuesday morning for you. And on Sunday night here, there was some other big news I want to talk to you about, which was, as everybody probably knows at this point, Missouri All-American defensive end Michael Sam came out. He told the New York Times and ESPN that he was gay. And in turn, that means that unless somebody else in the NFL comes out before the draft, he very will likely or very likely will become the first openly gay professional football player. I'm wondering how you got the news over there and what your first thought was when you heard it.
I had two projects to do, one of which I'd been working on for 3 weeks, and I worked on them all through the night, which wasn't my plan, but it just happened that way. And I believe it was about 6:15, and I'd been up all night when an email came in
This is
from
always
my.
when this kind of news happens, by the way, when you're in the middle of other big projects.
Yeah. And I see this email of the New York Times link, and I thought, I just, I had watched Missouri play, but I hadn't really noticed. I can't say I really noticed him. And so I watched him play in the SEC title game. So I just thought, you know, I wanted to write something. So I wrote it from, spent from about 6:30 to about 9:30 doing that. So I was up until 11 in the morning. But I just thought it was, you know, I started watching video of him, and I was absolutely floored by him. So I always knew that whoever was going to do this was going to be somebody with some certain amount of gumption, you know. But he, there's something about him that just I was really amazed, I have to say. And so that kind of kept me going in the Sochi morning. I completely forgot I was in Russia. I forgot, you know, I was in here just studying it and reading it, you know, all the reaction and so on. And it was an odd, you know, place to pick up this news and to learn this.
Well, you mentioned gumption, and a lot of people have used the word courage, which I think is a very apt word here. But in your column for us that you were up writing after this long night of other writing, you talked about how Michael chucked aside, I'm going to quote you, "a lot of rational and irrational fear, which is the daily enemy in so much of our life." In his case, what kind of fear are we talking about? Because I think people can throw around the word courage with everything, but I'm curious, rational, irrational fear. I feel like you're referring to something there, but I was hoping you could
Sure.
elaborate on that.
Sure. I think, you know, I think at certain times you do fear simply because gay people are attacked sometimes. It's rare, but it happens. And I think as a gay person, which I am, you fear that
For just
ultimately. You
first,
f
pers for your personal physical safety.
That's right. And that falls under the category of irrational because it's rare enough that I don't think it's the kind of thing, you know, that you should s spend time worrying about, you know, but it does flare up in the brain or whatever, you know, and it does happen from time to time where, you know, or has happened to me from time to time where you think about it. And it's, you know, obviously that could be more, you know, I don't know if that's something that he would consider, but it could be, or that happens to him. So that was one thing I was thinking about. That's just a marginal one. That I was thinking more, when the rational ones are, how are you going to put up with the amount of spite that you are going to get? And it, as I said in the column, that's a lot less spite than it would have been 20 years ago. The people who fling it are now in the margins to a degree that shocks me still, of the speed of which the culture has moved on this. And so, but it is going to come. It's going to, and are you going to go looking for it? Are you going to avoid it? Are you going to hear relatives say, "Well, I heard so and so say this," that, you know, so what are you going to do about that? And I think that's where I'm really impressed with him, because at age 24, because I think it takes most of us a lot longer to develop the hide to put up with that, and to realize that's just part of life, and you can't really, you know, dwell on it.
Can I ask you too, there's another type of fear I was thinking of, and I don't know if I'm off base or on base with this, which is, and I feel like this is a very, like the fears you were just talking about, this is a very universal kind of fear as well, which is I don't think this is unique necessarily to someone who's gay coming out, but almost to anyone who is revealing something about themselves that in some way makes them vulnerable or potentially vulnerable. There's almost like that fear of rejection by other people. Does that,
Yes.
do you know what I'm
Oh,
saying?
yeah.
I wonder,
Yeah.
is that part of the fear you're talking about too?
Yes, it is. And in fact, spite, I guess, is a form of rejection.
Oh,
But yeah,
absolutely.
it's a.
Yeah, anger, spite, being shunned. I think those are all deep down the same thing. It's that feeling of being rejected.
And do I think that I'd like to. I don't. I'd like to see people, including him, and including I've worked on it for myself, get to the point where you really can hear those things or read those things, if they're comments or whatever, without getting angry, without getting upset, without getting hurt. I think it's possible to get to that point. I think he, from what I can tell, and the way he expresses himself, might be farther along toward that than most 24-year-olds I've ever seen. Yeah, I do. You know, is it wrong, the things that people say to gay people and to other people who are different? Sure, it is. But I've often thought that sometimes in the gay community, we dwell too much on the hurt, you know, from those types of comments, and not enough on just building toward where we just dismiss them. And I think, of course, in society, it's going to become easier to dismiss them as they become rarer. So that's one thing. But
And the people saying them become more marginalized as well.
definitely, and to the degree that's happened already floors me. So.
I want to ask you about that. There was a I thought a really look at, and this is going to be so different 5, 10, 15, 20 years than it is now, but something that struck me as kind of it was definitely ironic, and I'm not sure what qualifier I would slap onto the word irony there, but the fact that here was Michael Sam coming out on, in the New York Times, on ESPN, coming across incredibly comfortable with his decision. Like you said, just seemed to have a lot of pluck, did not seem scared, seemed very at peace with what he was doing. There was no, I had no feeling of anxiety watching him. Seemed like he was really well prepared and thought it through and was really ready for this moment. And then there was this couple of articles where you have anonymous NFL people weighing in, mostly on what's this going to mean for his draft status in the locker room and blah, blah, blah. But what struck me was the fact that all these other people felt as though they had to speak anonymously in order to be honest about this.
Ah,
Whereas
yeah.
he did not, does not have to hide who he is. And I thought there was like
Yeah.
kind of an interesting inversion there, and it says a lot about sort of where we've been and maybe where we're going.
I hadn't thought of that, and that is very much an inversion. Absolutely.
I'm not trying to
And
blow your mind here, Chuck, just something that struck me.
and we are in the, everybody would have an ultimate example of the inversion that they've heard. And for me, still the ultimate one is when Dana White, the president of UFC, who is an unquestionably, you know, a brilliant businessman, marketer, whatever. But when he said that they would welcome a gay fighter there because we only have we have good people working for us. So the idea that in UFC that you had, you know, the president saying, you know, that if you were to criticize this or deride this, you're not a good person.
Right.
So
and
that,
he's taking, you know, a step beyond just saying, oh, we would welcome gay fans and fighters because, you know, gay fans have money, which is sort of the other thing that people always say, right? You know, everything's green to us kind of deal.
Right.
But he's taken another step and said, no, it's actually really wrong.
Right. And that is not something I expected to see, you know, in my life from in the U.S. from those kinds of levels, you know, it's funny to hear the NFL guys say they're not ready. And I understand that. I understand that that could be true. They know their league. So I understand, but the SEC is ready clearly. And the NFL isn't. That's funny too.
That is upside down. Is it not? I mean,
at least
what we think. If I'm just I'm going to stereotype here. If I stereotype what I think of SEC country versus NFL country, I definitely think red states versus a mix of red and blue states. And I think at least sort of politically and culturally less friendly to gay people, but apparently SEC, at least as a football league, as a scholastic league, not so much. I mean, is a really popular sign.
And I think what so often gets left out of it is that this generation of which he's a member and of which his teammates are a member, I don't even think those of us who are in generations before theirs really have a feel of how they think about this issue. And it's clear that the way they think about this issue is that they are completely at peace with it. I mean, to a percentage of them that is, you know, overwhelming, that they've lived with it as a reality on whether on TV or in their schools. You know, I don't know. I want to talk to more of them and see. They just think that they think it's insane that anybody ever thought of this in any kind of different way.
I mean, it's great. I mean, it's a lot of ways similar to racial bigotry and how that changed. And I think you're right in terms of most bigotry deep down, it's rooted, what we talked about earlier, it's rooted in fear. In this case, the fear of the idea of something that's different or other or threatening to you in some way. And like you said, when you live with someone of a different race, different sexual orientation, whatever it is, I think pretty quickly, and probably especially in a football situation, in a team situation, a locker room situation where you're around someone working so often, I think pretty quickly that whole weird, like, oh, something's different, just fades away and you just realize actually it's not different at all.
I think that's why the coming out of people over the last, I don't know, what would you say, 20, 30 years has been so important, because whether they came out, you know, just to the people they know and their families, ultimately it comes down to, I think people, when they make choices on how they feel about these things, can we live with this? And they've decided, yes, we absolutely can. And I think when I talk to, at least for me, it's the children of my peers who are now turning 20, 21, right in there. And they not only can live with it, but they want to.
Right.
So
I want to ask you about those. You wrote in your piece that, you know, one of the things that floored you watching Michael Sam talk was being a gay person who experienced what you called a long struggle through a different era. You know,
yeah.
Michael, he's 24. I'm just wondering, how old are you now?
51.
You're 51. So I'm 30. So I just turned 37. So I'm kind of in the in-between place there. So I can understand some of what you talk about when you talk about a different era. I can understand some of what you talk about when you talk about what 20-year-olds are like now. What was it like for you when you were 24? What was it? I mean, I don't want you to extrapolate your experience to every gay man in America, because that wouldn't be fair. But what was your experience like, and how does it compare to what you're seeing now?
Well, you could. I mean, I was around people who would have been accepting, but I never gave them the chance. That used to happen a lot, and to the point where it insulted them sometimes, when I was 22, I had a friend who was a lesbian who committed suicide, and that was, I think that was something that made me even, less apt to deal with it,
Did that
and
create
it,
more fear for you in a
I
way?
think so. I think so. And it made it and more grimness, and I just think there was less of it viewed in the culture. There was here was this thing that's normal to so many species, but was kind of very much not completely in secret. Certainly, it was talked about. It was joked about. It was there were people when I went to college who were open. Very few, but there were. And but you could boy, denial is a very powerful skill that a lot of us have, or tactic or trait or something that talent that a lot of us have, that you can absolutely convince yourself that it's actually not true if you don't want it to be. And a lot of it, of course, is it's that old saying, all sin is geographical. So a lot of it, I grew up in a small town in Virginia, so that's different from growing up in Los Angeles or something like that. But it's very hard to explain to people now what it was like then. I remember when I first moved to Atlanta, I was 20, 22 then, and I went to a club with some friends of mine, including that friend who ultimately died, and I just thought, I thought these people are really strange, and I think they were sort of, they did sort of separate themselves from general society more at that point than happens now. You see sometimes now in towns where gay bars are sort of drying up because the integration into society is so, so rapid and so thorough these meeting places aren't necessarily, these meeting places where you can go and feel comfortable, that was the point of it, aren't necessary anymore.
Because you feel comfortable kind
Everywhere,
of everywhere.
right? Most everywhere.
I mean, that's a, I mean, to me, that's an amazing indicator of progress, but also, I mean, there's something a little poignant though about also what gets lost in that too.
Yes.
Although I
You mean
think that
lot
the trade is very much worth it, probably.
The trade is worth it. You know what it reminds me of? It reminds me of the trade of when New York went from a, this is completely different, but New York went from a more edgy, kind of semi-scary place where people could, make it on a lower income to this really safe place full of subways, full of tourists. It's like that trade-off. You do lose something, and I think there are a lot of, especially older gay people, who will tell you that they have lost something in the trade-off, but something not nearly so valuable as what has been gained.
Feeling acceptance, feeling comfortable, feeling like you're a part of society as opposed to something you have
Right.
to hide in society in
Well,
plain sight.
just not having to expend that energy on hiding. Hiding is hard work,
That has
so.
to be incredibly draining. I always wonder. People. I read some stuff today where they talk. Again, the common NFL trope of like, what if this is a distraction? There's going to be more media. Blah blah blah. Like, I tried to point out something I wrote today. When you play professional sports, you're inviting a lot of media attention. That's kind of why you're allowed to play professional sports and make money at it. It's kind of the whole point of it.
Right.
You play football, but your real job is harvesting eyeballs for advertisers. I mean, it's kind of similar to what we do. That's what all entertainers do, essentially.
Right.
But I felt like the notion that, well, now this guy is making things harder for himself, And maybe that's true in some ways with sort of where NFL culture is. But I thought to myself, psychologically, I feel like maybe he's making things way easier for himself because what you just talked about, like he can now, in theory, put all or most of his energy, if he wants, into just becoming as good at football as he possibly could be and does not have to siphon off like emotional and psychic energy into hiding something, essentially, which I think what you said is true. It's got to be incredibly draining.
Yeah, I think in keeping with that, I have a friend who went to Missouri as a, huge fan, who still follows the team, and he said if he could look back on it, he thinks he played better after that, and that there could, he wants to study it more, but there really could be something too, that he, that Sam, actually improved and, seemed to, if you look back on it now, seemed to have been sort of set free in some way.
I mean, look, if you look
So.
at, I think it's totally plausible. If you look at even, this is a little bit of a tangent, you look at like what teams like the Seahawks are doing in terms of mental work, so to speak, sort of mental conditioning, getting people sort of, not just working on your physical skills, but sort of on your mental skills, on feeling centered, on feeling comfortable, on practicing mindfulness, meditation, all these kinds of things that sort of bring about like positivity and inner peace and things that probably at one point we would scoff at in sports culture, but it turns out they're pretty important in life and in sports. I just have to think that in Sam's case, I feel like, again, maybe it's a trade-off, but I feel like maybe the ways he's going to make it easier for himself are going to way outweigh whatever kind of flack or pushback he's going to get by the world knowing he's gay.
It absolutely could be, and it's that's plausible, completely. It's
I want to before we get over to the Olympics, I want to ask you just a couple more things about this. Is there any special significance in your mind that he plays football and we're not talking about basketball or hockey or baseball? I mean, beyond the fact that football is sort of like the most popular sport right now, is there any other sort of cultural meaning you think in there?
yes. Yes, completely. And I'm always loath to say it because it maybe feeds into stereotypes that I've long since learned not to buy anymore. But not only that it's football, but that he's a defensive lineman, that he charges and sacks quarterbacks, and that he was the MVP of his team, and I guess the whole team, right? Yeah, the SEC Defensive Player of the Year and
Right.
the MVP of the team, of Missouri's team. There's something about that position that does kill off maybe some lingering stereotypes that again we've long since learned, not to follow anyway, but that there's an element of that. I can't figure out if that's if I date myself when I say that, but certainly when I grew up, there was an idea of gay men as effeminate, and that's the way we saw it when we were kids. And the idea of an NFL level or close to NFL level defensive lineman would have been a real jolt to us. And I do mention in my column that these guys who were stereotyped are some of the toughest people in all society, guys branded effeminate because they've taken more nonsense and guff than just about anybody you can name. So in that light, I remember Jason Collins came out and he said, "Well, I don't fit the stereotype." And I thought, well, I would kind of avoid saying that if I were you, but it does help in some way, I think, maybe with a certain segment of society who will look at that and say, I guess anybody could be. Maybe in the same way it helped that in my father's generation, when, as my father once told me this, that when Rock Hudson
Right. I was
was,
thinking that.
yeah,
I
so.
mean, look, I mean, like you said, it's probably is a generational thing, and maybe the like really young generation doesn't need any help. They don't have those stereotypes in the first place. But
That's right.
look, I've seen
Yeah.
enough horror movies to know it never hurts to put another stake into Jason's heart. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
Like it doesn't like it doesn't hurt to slam the coffin shut a little harder on Dracula. You never know when
right.
he's gonna come back out. So.
That's true. This may not be having any effect at all on people in Sam's generation, but yeah, you're right. There are other segments and ages out there that who can see this and say, "Ah, well, it's pretty universal."
Yeah,
So.
let me ask you this. Now this might be a more serious or a more lighthearted question, depending on how you take it. I always call this it's such a cliche, and it's to me it's so stupid, but it's the shower question, and it just always comes up whenever you're talking about gay athletes or when you're talking about female reporters in male locker rooms. Most recently, this was from Jonathan Vilma, a player who I actually kind of like because he stood up to the NFL. Or try to stay up to the NFL on Bounty Gate, which I found to be a total okey-doke farce, but that's for another podcast. But here's his quote, and this actually, he said this just a few days before Sam came out. This is what he said. He said, imagine, and he was talking about a hypothetical gay player in the NFL, out of the closet gay player, because we know there's plenty of gay players in the NFL and have been. Imagine if he's the guy next to me, and I get dressed naked, taking a shower, the whole nine. And by the way, I just want to say that that was kind of like a weird inverse order of how the process actually happens. But anyway, I'll get back to the quote. So here's the quote again. I get dressed, naked, taking a shower, the whole nine. Guy's next to me, and it just so happens he looks at me. How am I supposed to respond? Close quote. Well, besides like me invoking a fainting couch here, Chuck, what's wrong with this whole scenario? Because this is the kind of thing they actually do here more than once. This seems to be like sort of a sticking point for some people.
This is sort of the obsession of a country founded by Puritans, isn't it? I mean,
I think so. That's a really good point. Keep going with that.
it's really it is, it's something that even let's take it all the way to the example that he provided there. It's so easily solved. You, what am I supposed to do? Well, you're supposed to turn around and look the other way, probably, There's very, very easy solutions to that. It's just like when we had huge national discussions, 25 years ago over women as reporters. And, I remember the quarterback Jim Everett was with the Rams then saying, "Well, we have an invention called the towel. It's really easy. You can just use a towel."
Right.
And it's so funny these. I mean, it's not.
Go ahead.
It's. We're used to it. It's very common,
Right.
these kinds of, in our culture, these kinds of
I
concerns.
mean, it kind of
But there's.
reminds me a little of a long time ago when John Amici
Uh-huh.
was talking, or maybe it was an article he had written in ESPN magazine about coming out, and he talked about during his playing days. At one point, Greg Ostertag, of all people, asked him something like the effect of, "Dude, are you gay?" And John Amici had to me what I thought was like the funniest answer, but also a really appropriate one. Where he's like, "Greg, you have nothing to worry about." And I just felt like I feel like sometimes in this situation, it's like, again, I'm not an NFL player, but I've played some sports and I've been in a locker room afterwards, and I've been tired and sore. And I wrote about this like, if you put me in a locker room full of Victoria's Secret models, and I guess I'm outing myself as straight here. If I was all beat up at the end of an NFL practice and I'm at the end of a long work day, I'm not sure that I'm thinking like a sports locker room, which is like the most, like industrial environment possible. I'm probably just thinking about getting clean and getting the hell out of there and getting home. And did I need to drop off my dry cleaning? And what time is dinner? And it's like work. It's like work. It's like I
Right.
don't, I almost wonder sometimes, like for someone like Vilma, if you just like, well, stop a second, just put yourself into the mind. It doesn't matter if someone's gay, just put yourself in someone else's mind. Like, Are you getting into the shower at the end of the day and that's all you're thinking about is like, ooh, like what if I see someone I find attractive in the shower? Hey there. It's kind of like, I think this is kind of a different space, a different mental place.
That's true. I think that is true. I think that sometimes people and Vilma in this case, maybe think about gay people only as pertains to sex.
Yeah, it's almost
That's
like just
been
putting
a
you in this
yeah.
little box of like, well, that's the only thing that really is your identity, and that's all you're thinking about, and that's the only way I can think about you.
Right. And then I always used to think about, I've heard a lot of men through the years say this, that, well, I don't mind what they do, but I just don't want them to hit on me, And then when you think about it, especially football players, it's like if someone hits on you, you're gonna beat them up, and no one's gonna condemn you for that, or you're gonna push them away or whatever, no one's gonna
Or even you could just say no, thank you. I mean, you could just
right.
not beat someone up and be like, hey, I'm sorry, actually, I'm straight. That's very
But the
flattering. We'll move on now.
And because of that, what are the chances that, obviously, as you say, Sam is, if he does end up in an NFL locker room, is going to be, I think he's probably, if I could think about it myself, he's going to be a little more cautious maybe than, I don't know if that's how he did it at Missouri. He's going to be a little more, less apt to maybe horse around, although I don't really think that's a big thing in pro locker rooms anyway,
I
but
don't think there's a lot of towel stomping going on in the pro
no,
locker room.
no, and no, I
And
don't think
also
a
the
lot
fact
of.
that it is work. I mean, like it's like most people are at this point, I think again in our culture are pretty much like at least when they're at the office, they are smart enough to not only not entertain any kind of romantic thoughts, whether you're gay or straight for your coworkers, but definitely you're not going to act on any of them at the office. I mean, maybe we're talking like a 1980s office Christmas party here. I just don't really
Yeah.
see this being a huge area of concern. I mean, I suppose there's sexual harassment and things like that, but I would think you'd worry about something like that more from a boss than you would from a coworker. I don't know.
It's very odd. Yeah, it's Sam or whoever is not going to do anything to jeopardize his career,
Right.
And then okay, let's say that if somebody actually did do something to jeopardize his career, you're going to the object of that is going to be able to handle it. So that boy, that is that is a that's just so odd. It's both a familiar part of our culture and so strange at the
I mean,
same
I
time.
think it goes back to what you said at the beginning. There's To all of this issue, there just is like an underlying element of fear. And if, until we get to, I think, talk about, recognize, and honestly deal with the fear element, we don't really get anywhere. But once we do that, then it pretty much resolves itself. And when you talk about the younger generation, I feel like they're past that. They almost never had that fear element.
That's
That
right.
makes all, to me, I think that probably makes all a difference. Well, let's talk about the Olympics. That's, in theory, that's what we're supposed to be talking about here. Although I am going to do a sign of a transition here, which is the Russian government, as well reported and well documented, and it's not like they're shy about this. They're very repressive towards LGBT people. And again, this is not anonymous NFL front office types talking about your sliding draft stock. This is arrests, intimidation, beatings, and worse. I want to know for you, being in Russia to cover the Olympics, and this is part of your job as a sports writer, it's a great sports event. Is there an element of just like cognitive dissonance of also being in this same country as someone who's gay? And like you said, walking around this beautiful resort town, but you must know somewhere in your mind, this country, at least in terms of its official government, is not. And this is a euphemism, particularly friendly towards gay people. I mean, sort of, how do you deal with those two things coexisting?
Well, I do look at it as, I do always remember where I am, as I sort of travel the world, and I know that in Spain or Denmark or Norway, I was just in Norway, so I'm gonna act, I'm gonna be a little more, I don't say I act differently, but I'm going to be Here, as I walk around, I'm much more aware of surroundings. I'm much more, I do think about, I do, that's probably the difference. I do think about the law and I think about the culture here in a way that I never think about it when I'm in a place like Spain or something like that. You know, just never even, never even comes to mind. So, you know, it's not that I would do anything that was going to get me in trouble anyway, but I just think about, you know, where I am. So, but on the other hand, there's also a huge parallel here because there's a generational thing with this too. Because most Russian youth are much different, maybe not to the level of European youth or American youth or Western European youth or American youth, but on this issue, and they see they kind of laugh off the law, from what I've experienced talking to them so
Interesting.
far. They think it's the old zombie Soviet, you know, kind of thing. They're not surprised by it. They kind of roll their eyes by it. They kind of think it's silly. You know, the mayor of Sochi said, "We don't have any gay people here. They have two or three gay clubs. I've been to one here." You know, so they obviously. Those people are undergoing some sort of transformation when they go in, and then when they come back out, and then they're straight again, you know. So,
Right, it's a sort of time space wormhole.
make it a lot easier, huh? So, but yeah. So, there's the people I've talked to have told me that the Russian people here have talked to about it, have told me that to live here and be gay here is no problem. It's pretty easy. It's you know, you're maybe you're you don't have the level of maybe you're not quite as open. It's a little bit different from the US in that regard, but in every country there's always some sort of disconnect between the laws
And the people.
and what are actually the cultural standards, right, and the people. So, and I think this is one. I'm not saying that as a society, it's overwhelming. It is over. I think the law is supported. I think even among people who know gay people and love gay people in their lives, the law is largely supported, or at least that's what polls show. I think, but it's the way it's been put to me is as this. The people who remember the Soviet Union, when people were constantly told by the government that this was a bad thing, you know, those as that generation, you know, departs more and more. I don't, one guy told me, he said this law will be gone in 20 years. So,
Let's hope so.
yeah.
Let me ask you, this is a related question, and it's kind of a more broader general one. For me, like the older I get with sports, it's harder for me to sort of compartmentalize things like basically compartmentalizing like the on-field play, the games themselves, which I love, obviously, and some of this sort of off-field sausage making that goes into them. I mean, like for instance, you know, I've written about this with football. I can't watch it anymore because I just know too much about the brain damage that's happening. With the NCAA, I'm a huge critic of the amateur economy, but I can still watch college sports. I really enjoy the actual games, but there is a little part of me, a big part of me, that actually kind of fumes when I'm watching because I'm still thinking about that. I feel like the Olympics are always like the ultimate version of this kind of dissonance because, you know, in fairness to Russia, like corruption's an Olympic tradition. There's always a massive amount of shadiness behind the scenes. You know, in this case, we've also got like, you know, the Putin regime and these anti-gay laws and other things that are kind of offensive and odious. I'm just wondering, have you have any issues with sort of putting those things aside and just enjoying the games themselves, the competition, the good things that come out of them?
I have
Do you have any problem with that? I mean, do you have to deal with that at all, or is it like that's I know how to do that.
I have chronic and persistent issues with this, you know, what to make of it, and you know, the amount of corruption, the amount of doping, the, you know, I once called up that, I was at the Sydney Olympics, I called up the doping expert at Penn State, Charles
I
Yeccelles, and
love Charles Yeccelles,
I
by the
do
way.
too.
He's the
I do too.
best.
He
What a
really is.
education he's given me over the last decade. But I'm gonna have
See,
to have him on a podcast sometime.
even when he kind of chews me out, because he's kind of gruff, said and about why weren't you people in the gyms interviewing people and then learning about this,
Right.
I still listen to him. I love listening to him. But I called him and asked him which, I think there were 31 sports in that Olympics. I said, I wonder, I want to run through the list for you, sir, and which ones, I can watch without worrying about if
Oh
somebody's
boy.
doping. And he said, let me stop you right there, He said, then we came down to there was only one sport where he thought doping would not improve performance. And there were sports like archery where he said it does, and table tennis, which I hadn't really, I said, surely table tennis is innocuous. And and then he was right, because I think the first doping,
Was a table tennis player,
I
I
think
heard.
it positive of that gate, those games. Yeah. And, but sailing, he said, was the only one you probably could watch. And since then, I've covered sailing, and I thought, well, this is absolutely an athletic pursuit, the way
Yeah.
these guys move around these boats. And so I think he might have even been wrong on that one.
Oh,
But,
I think so. I think, I mean, look, there's doping in chess, there's doping in everything. That's the way I
right.
see it.
It's very, yeah. I grapple with, I still get, I still get sort of goosebumps or emotional at certain parts of Olympics.
Sure.
So there's some sort of odd, dissonance going on there with me, because I still refuse to stop liking them, even as I know that you can't be naive about what they're increasingly about.
Oh,
So.
when I was in Athens, I tell people all the time, people ask me, what's the best sports moment you've ever been to or covered or whatever? And I'm always like, wasn't even the race. It's the 15 minutes on the field before the 100 meter final at the
Oh,
Olympics. Like just the absolute electricity of that
yeah.
scene. And every guy, you never, I mean, I hate to cast aspersions, but you're pretty sure every guy on the track is, they turn off the lights, they glow in the dark. I
Yeah.
mean, I have no illusions about how world records fall in sprinting. And
Right.
personally, I don't really have as much of a moral, necessarily a moral objection. I'm still working on sort of the pros and cons of that within my own mind. But the actual event, it's just so electric and so exciting and so, I mean, I can't really put it into words. It's the anticipation for you're about to see maybe someone might run faster than anyone's ever run ever. And
Yeah,
you're about to
yeah.
see this. And it's like everybody can feel that. And it's sort of those are the kind of moments that make sports so compelling, I think.
Yeah, it's
And even
yeah.
with all the crap that goes on in them and around them, because they are part of life, they're not separate. The sports page isn't actually a real thing, separate from the rest of the world. There's something kind of always compelling and in some ways redeeming just because of that.
And the mix of all the countries and cultures
Sure.
is always a great thing. It just is, it's yeah. I told somebody, one way I've learned to kind of cope with it is to joke about the doping in terms of I actually love this idea, and I realize that this is perverse, I'm sure, but I love this idea that you can finish fourth, but you can still get a bronze medal like 6 years later if some investigation comes up and one of the medalists is disqualified.
You never
So
know. They hold on to those samples now. You never know.
there's one of these in cross country skiing right now where the Turin 2006 gold medalist is under suspicion. So somebody asked the silver medalist the other day, I was, do you think you're going to get another gold? Because she had just won a gold the other day. So,
Wow, that's
the New York Times has been doing this thing about fourth place finishers, how
I
that's
saw
the most.
that.
Yeah, it's a good idea. I think it's a really good idea. But I was telling one of the editors, I think you ought to focus on fifth place, because fourth place people still have hope,
Yeah, right. They do now. You need to ask
So,
them all about that.
yeah, I think you're in the wrong, you've got to adjust it a little bit for modern days.
How was the coverage over here in the States, the first few days before the games and even over the weekend, it was pretty obsessively focused on the icky looking water that you're not supposed to wash your face with, the stray
Right.
dogs we mentioned, the unfinished construction, Russia not being ready. And as someone who went to, like I said, the Athens games, a lot of that was similar to the Athens. I mean, I remember getting to the stadium for the opening ceremonies and they were literally still planting trees out front. But from what you've seen on the ground and where you've been so far, do you feel like that kind of coverage is fair or kind of overblown?
I feel like I've always thought it was overblown because people didn't care and shouldn't care what journalists' quarters are like.
Right. Our
Until
complaining is boring.
right, until I give credit for to Bruce Arthur from the National Post in Canada, who was
Love Bruce
explaining.
Arthur, by the way. A friend
Yeah, me too.
of my Twitter account, and I think a friend
Okay.
of Sports on Earth in a way too.
Yeah, I think so, definitely. But I give him credit for this. He said, "You know what? Yeah, that's right, but it's still," and he wrote it just like this. He wrote, "Nobody cares where we're staying, but it's still part of your report card on how well you pulled it off." And Olympics to Olympics, that's still, how well did it go? How well was it pulled off? How much was the community or the city
Sure.
galvanized for it,
Well,
So
on that front, at least in one event, some of this same kind of thing is affecting competition. I'm thinking of the half pipe, the snowboard, where I've seen the competitors have been ripping the IOC. And I should note, not Russia. They're actually ripping the IOC,
Right.
essentially for building the half pipe on the cheap. Over at Yahoo, my friend Jeff Passan. He said he basically called for a boycott today. He said the snowboarders need to boycott, sort of take their sport back and not put up with this, basically like crappy and dangerous conditions. I don't know if you've been over there, you've been following this. The Olympics are huge and there's a lot of stuff to follow.
Right.
Just wondering if you have any thoughts on that specific situation or if you've seen anything like that with any of the other venues or sports.
There was a some of the competitors in the, I think it was during the practice runs in the
Ski jump.
downhill.
Oh, the downhill. Okay.
Oh, was it ski?
Is
Yeah.
it ski jump? Ski jump or downhill, I think. One or the other. Maybe
Thought that
both.
that was a little that one was a little rank, and you don't know how much of this has to do with the weather, which isn't that cold.
Right. Even in the mountains, it's not
Even in
cold.
the mountains, right. Even in the mountains, it was very pleasant. I went up there Saturday. And by the way, those you never hear about these mountains, and when you hear about the world's great mountains, and but they are so impossibly beautiful, just
Really?
stunning. Oh, so and there's talk about the what in the slope style, right? Or is it the slope style? The coaches will have a meeting and try to, or maybe it's the half pipe now. Ooh, but they're gonna have a meeting and try to assess what to do. Whether some people are saying this event will be postponed. I've never seen anything like that. This is my sixth Olympics, so I've never seen anything like that in an Olympics. So where it got to that far that I can think of. I was trying to think of it. One thing I have noticed that I think is fascinating is that, with regard to the journalists' quarters, like we were talking about, I think that this is the we were talking about this, I forget with who, but this is the first time ever that the people back at home really did care, and they're really into it. I got so many questions about what's your room like? What's the wa is the water brown? And I
Right.
wonder what the interest has been so great. The guy who busted through his door, all that, the interest in that kind of thing has been so great that it makes me wonder if, okay, here was this former rival of our country, and do we revel in the idea that they can't put it together, at least in the view of, when you look at people checking into a hotel room and there's a stray dog in there. That happened to the German photographer. That's my favorite story.
Yeah, that's right. I read that one. I've got
Now
a.
that said, the venues are magnificent. So, except
Right.
for the one we were talking about.
Right. Well, I have a theory, which is I think one of the reasons this stuff has garnered so much interest is because social media is available. These are the kinds of things that get traction and you're interested in on social media, a lot because in some ways too, you feel sort of a more personal connection to these various sports reporters that you follow.
I think that's,
you know,
right.
You're kind of and it's also, you know, we're the Facebook generation now, so we're the, you know, we put our dinner on Instagram and pictures of the most mundane things on Facebook, but they're not mundane. We're actually interested in each other at that level. And I feel like that sort of set the table for us caring about this too. As much as I like your idea, we also like maybe there's some schadenfreude with Russia, you know, seeing them still be down a little bit, I guess, because we were rivals for so long. Although I have to say, by the way, you better didn't see us because you're there. At one point, they dragged out the old Soviet Olympic hockey coach from 1980, and had Al Michaels interviewing him.
Oh.
And it was just, to me, it was like, look, I'm as patriotic as the next person, but at some point it's like, yes, Miracle on Ice was amazing, but like, we have to move on as a country. Like, in fact, because we did win the Cold War, at this point to me, it's like absolutely like spiking the football when it's like, we actually won like 100-0 in the game. It's like, we don't need to keep going back to that amazing first quarter touchdown grab. Like, it's okay. We can let that go. It was a great moment, but we can move on now.
Especially when they won every other thing around it. You know, didn't they win every other Olympics? You know, that was our one, you know, little poke into their dynasty, I think.
Hockey wise,
for sure. Now,
let me ask you, so going forward, what are you most looking forward to coming up the rest of this week that you're planning to cover sports wise?
Well, I think this ice hockey, men's ice hockey tournament is just beyond belief. It's so loaded, so stacked. It's just one of the, it could go so many ways.
Have you covered Olympic hockey before?
Yes,
okay,
in
good.
Salt Lake.
So you, okay. Yeah. Oh, I was there too.
Yeah.
You know, like that made me basically, I hate to say this, but that made me less of a fan of NHL hockey because I couldn't go back to watching it afterwards.
Oh, yeah, you mean because the intensity was so much?
Well, the intensity, the skill level, because, you know, the bigger rink. So everyone, and also you have the bigger rink, you have the best players, and by best players, the most skilled players. So basically, like, nobody's on the ice just because they're tough or can dig a puck out of the corner.
Yeah.
No offense, because that's a skill too, but I just mean in terms of like aesthetically pleasing hockey, that is still hard hitting.
Right.
Olympic hockey can't be beat. It's just the quality is so high.
Yeah, you know, and I think about, I always think about if I could be in any arena that I missed on a given day, that U.S.-Canada gold medal match in Vancouver, which I was not there, that would rank in my top three, I'm sure. Just the look of that thing on TV was just, that building must have been so, you know, tense and scared, you know, at the same time. And
Wow.
So this tournament has all of this, all the regular, I think Sweden won the gold in two Olympics ago, so
they did. And
you know,
Russia's got the pressure on for being the
right, and then you throw on top of the whole pile of it, which would be considerable anyway, and then you throw the whole presence of the home team and the expectations there, and on top of the pile, and I just think, you know, I keep they have this Olympic handbook with the schedule, and I keep looking, when's the hockey going to start? You know, and I can't wait to see Russia play, and then maybe we have a translator here. Maybe we'll have her read the papers or something, or the websites for me the next day, just to see what the reaction is.
Yeah, of the stuff you've been to so far, what was your favorite?
Well, I have to say that I purposely went to the biathlon here because I'd never seen it anywhere, and B, I knew that it was it's a Russian priority. It's a big deal here. It's a sport that Vladimir Putin really likes, and it's a sport that Prokhorov, the Nets owner, has financed.
Oh, really?
Leading up to these Olympics, he's the president of the Russian Biathlon Federation. You know, and they're flying around on private jets, whatever, the biathletes. So I went there, and I was floored by, first of all, the venue is stunningly beautiful. When you look out the back of it, the mountains are It's one of the most beautiful scenes I've ever seen in my life. But the but then the what really gets me about Bathlon is the, you know, it's obviously odd, and you know, you have skiing and shooting. But when they finish and they collapse to the, just collapse to the snow, mm-hmm. and they're so spent, that's a little like cross country skiing in that way. Well, it is like cross country skiing, but you know,
with shooting,
just the idea of how exhausted they were,
mentally, you know, and physically,
sprawled out. Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah, that really. So thus far,
That's good. I never actually, when I was in Salt Lake, I didn't see that. I'm gonna put in a quick plug for a sport that I completely enjoyed in Salt Lake, which was the freestyle aerials. I don't know if you've gone to see those in person before.
Is that when they debuted? Isn't that when
they did debut it? Yeah. And so it's, you know, it's the one where they basically do like it's just a series of can you top this crazy flipping ski jumps. It's kind of like inverse platform diving. It's a high platform diving. And it's thrilling because it is a can you top this thing, and every single one's that moment of like, is this person gonna stick it or just completely wipe out?
Right.
And it's a little bit of rubbernecky kind of appeal, and I don't know, maybe if I should be that into a sport like that again, knowing more about sort of the damage that can be done.
Right.
But it is exciting, and it's incredible what they're able to do in the air. If you get a chance, I would definitely go check that out. It was a different kind of atmosphere and crowd. It was really, you know what it was like, actually? It was a little bit like the weightlifting in the summer games, where they just try to top each other with the amount of weight on the bar. It was cool.
I love the weightlifting.
Oh, I love it too. By the way, if anybody out there listening gets a chance to go to summer games, you got to go to the weightlifting one day.
Yeah.
It will not disappoint.
Two of the greatest things I've seen in any sport are in weightlifting. So.
Pocket Hercules.
Yeah, that was one.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Oh, what a day.
Well, look, we're running out of time here, and I know you need to get some sleep, or you got to start your day one or the other.
I'm going to sleep.
I really want to have you come back on next week for part two, when we can talk about all the stuff you've seen and covered. Can we do that?
Sure. Absolutely.
Awesome. Awesome. And before we go, how can people find you on Twitter?
It's Chuck Culpepper 1, the numeral 1 on Twitter.
And that's Chuck Culpepper 2 P's.
3 total.
Yes, so 3 total, 2 P's.
Pepper, like, yeah.
Uh-huh. Pepper, common spelling of pepper.
Right, right.
All right. And Chuck, anything else? Anywhere else we can find you? Sports on Earth, of course.
That's right, Sports on Earth, yes.
And also, literally and physically, if you want to find Chuck, he is probably somewhere on Earth. But I mean that, like, he is our roving reporter, so he's always somewhere different. I never know where he's going to be, but it's always somewhere good.
Designated nomad.
That's right. So Chuck Culpepper, thank you so much. And do stay safe. I'll be reading your dispatches at Sports on Earth. And in the meantime, I'm Patrick Ruby, also for Sports on Earth, saying goodbye, Ruby Tuesday.